Thank you, Simon, and welcome to our November board meeting. Another packed agenda, and without further ado, I invite our rate-regulated activities team to give us a heads-up on the remaining papers or the feedback. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. So at October 2021 meeting, the board discussed the feedback received on the main aspect of the model in the exposure draft, regulatory assets, and regulatory liabilities. The paper that we have prepared for today's meeting covered the feedback remaining received on the remaining aspect of the model. Specifically, we have four board papers for this meeting. The first one is Agenda Paper 9A, dealing with the presentation, and the second one is Agenda Paper 9B, dealing with the disclosure. The third one is the Agenda Paper 9C, dealing with the effective date and the transition, and the last one is Agenda Paper 9D, dealing with the likely effect. The board is not being asked to make decisions during today's meeting. However, for each paper, the staff will ask the board members to comment on any feedback that was unclear, that provides new information, or that needs further research. At our forthcoming meeting, we will discuss a plan for redeliberating proposals in the exposure draft. So now we will start from the Agenda Paper 9A. Let me give the floor to Shak Ma.
Thank you, Li-Cheng. So I'll go through basically the summary for Agenda Paper 9A presentation. This paper summarizes the feedback received on the proposed presentation requirements and the proposed amendments to IAS 1, Presentation of Financial Statements. In relation to the statements of financial performance, most respondents include users of financial statements, agreed proposal, presents all regulatory income minus all regulatory expense as a separate line item immediately below revenue. This line item would also include regulatory interest expense and regulatory interest income, and respondents agree with that as well. Some respondents actually, you know, including almost all respondents from Latin America, were of the view that the notion of revenue is actually broader than revenue from contracts with customers. And therefore, these respondents actually, you know, suggest that, you know, NTT either be permitted to or required to present the line item as part of revenue. The feedback is summarized in paragraphs 16 and 17 of the paper. A few respondents, including all respondents from Latin America, said that the regulatory interest income and regulatory interest expense should be included in finance income and finance expense, respectively. They actually support a consistency with presentation of the unwinding of discounts for other assets and liabilities. I'll now move on to the statement of financial position. The exposure draft did not ask a question on this, the proposal on this aspect. Nevertheless, a few respondents explicitly agreed with the proposal to present as a separate line item, regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. A few respondents disagreed or raised concerns about the proposed conditions for offsetting of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, and this actually summarized in paragraph 26 of the paper. I'll now move on to proposed amendments to IAS 1, Presentation of Financial Statements. A few respondents who commented actually asked how the proposed presentation would interact with the existing requirements in IAS 1, such as aggregation, disaggregation, and also current and non-current classification. I'll now hand over to the board for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Shak Ma. Any comments, any questions? There.
Thank you, staff, for the paper, bringing this for this meeting as well. A few comments here. First, on the revenue issue. I think that I found very interesting the combination of the comments on paragraph 14 and 16. The 14 says that because we have this line of regulatory income, some users may believe, for example, that this line contains all revenue from the regulated activity. It's something that could be explained, but for me at least, it's not is a reasonable comment. But when I go to comment on paragraph 16, when they actually, if I understood as a solution for them, to include a subtotal that would say the total revenue is not only the revenue under IFRS 15, but also the revenue under this exposure draft. I mean, that this actually would be the entire revenue. From the point of view of the recognition of revenue, at least for me, it makes sense. And I was just looking at the exposure draft. It's not clear whether they could or not imply a subtotal as total revenue, including IFRS 15. I really found that these comments very good. And another comment that I found interesting is on paragraph 21, in relation to the interest rate. Indeed, for many, and we have been having this discussion for primary financial statements as well, sometimes the interest rate is part of the main activity. And then I understand why in our proposal we say that this is part of the revenue, the regulatory revenue, for example, or expense. But what they are trying to say that sometimes it's just a matter of passage of time. It's not exactly a remuneration as a main activity. I'm just wondering whether what they are trying to say here is that maybe we should try to make a segregation when this is part of the main activity, and then it would be in the regulatory income and expense right after the revenue line, and those that are actually just the passage of time, similar to any other asset and liability, or especially liability covered by, for example, IS-37, it just would be a finance income or finance expense. I think that also some, it's a good comment that I think that we should try to explore exactly what they are trying to achieve here, is to make this segregation, or actually they believe that all interest income and expense should be classified as finance income and expense. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadeo. Mary?
Commenting on some of the same points that Tadeo covered in his remarks, looking at paragraph, I think it was 16, classifying the adjustments arising from regulatory income as revenue, that to me is a threshold no way kind of suggestion, because first of all, thinking about IFRS 15 and how it starts with the title of the standard, revenue from contracts with customers, and the rate regulator is not the regulatory agreement that gives rise to regulatory income and expense is not a contract with a customer. And so I think keeping segregation of those two is a critical aspect of our proposals. And it's something that we, thinking about it, I can't remember how explicit it is in IFRS 14. Certainly the segregation of regulatory adjustments is explicit, and I can't remember about revenue. So for me, I think we have to understand and be able to respond to that feedback. And maybe we have to think about whether, and I think I'm thinking ahead to PFS, so it's hard when it's interaction with a work in progress, our primary financial statement project, whether there would be any flex to allow, but I would not require, revenue as adjusted for regulatory income kind of subtotal. And I think we should think about that, but I would not be supportive of exploring further, because we have such a conclusive focus on IFRS 15 revenue, that revenue being from contracts with customers, and that's, so I would not pursue the separation. A couple of other things in here. The suggestion in paragraph 15 to provide relief from separate presentation if the regulatory activities are not significant, I think we should not do that. We have existing materiality requirements. We are working on finalizing additional guidance in the primary financial statement project about aggregation and disaggregation and when separate line items are required. I think that should be covered by the general principles, you know, when you would conclude that it was not sufficiently significant to require disaggregation on the face. And I would leave it at that. I thought the questions about have we really thought about the interaction of, let's say, unit of account with offsetting, which is a comment in paragraph 27, and interactions with the general aggregation, disaggregation. Those two comments are something that I think it would be helpful to see a little bit more analysis about, a follow-up paper to make sure that there aren't loose ends or bad fits. Now, it may be especially with the aggregation, disaggregation, you need to defer that until we've got tentative conclusions that we can use from the primary financial statement project. So it's not like it's an immediate thing, but that is something that I'd like to see follow-up on. And then the last things, and maybe it was the interaction with IS1 comments. I think as a general standard, as a design for this standard, that we should try and put anything that is a specific discussion about rate-regulated activities in the standard rather than having a bit in IS1 that says, you know, if you're applying this to an entity with rate-regulated activities, et cetera, et cetera. Because I think you're either going to have these activities or you're not. And if you're not, it just adds one more thing that you have to climb over when you're reading, you know, applying IS1. So I think it's good to think about these things, but I wouldn't automatically think of them as amendments to IS1 as opposed to including discussion in the standard about how some of the general requirements might apply in the setting of an entity with rate-regulated activities, and then including the guidance in this standard rather than as an amendment to IS1. I don't think, and the same thing applies, I think, to comments maybe about statement of cash flows. You know, rather than having lots of consequential amendments, I think I would make this a bit more of a single resource across a number of different areas of financial statements.
Bruce?
I was actually just going to say a lot of my points were made by Mary. I'm not going to repeat a lot of what she said. I guess just the only comment I really had was just around, I can see the confusion that people are getting on this revenue story. And I appreciate that, yes, we can go into the nuances of this, obviously, some with customers, but I think this ordinary course of activities, this is what people do. I would just, what we're asking, is there something more we could do? I think maybe just make clearer what we're intending people to do in that area, because otherwise I think we could have some interpretive issues when we get to issuing the standard. The other points were made earlier.
Thank you. Nick?
Thanks. So just to be clear, I agree with Mary, it's important we keep revenue separate from this new line of all regulatory income minus all regulatory expense. I do have some sympathy with the views expressed in paragraph 714, rather, that term, all regulatory income minus all regulatory expense, could be very easily interpreted as all regulated income minus all regulated expense. And clearly entities are free to rename that line themselves. But I think it's something worth thinking about. Entities that are also free to put in a subtotal, but it helps explain the relevance of the financial statements. Potentially that subtotal could be quite important, because to do any meaningful margin calculation, it's the aggregation of those two numbers, the revenue plus regulatory income minus regulatory expense, that you'll need to make a sensible margin calculation. And that's kind of the raison d'etre of what we're trying to do here. Just perhaps some further thought around that may be needed.
Thanks, Nick. Ginger.
Thank you, Andreas. I also have similar comments as Mary said, that first, in terms of the presentation of revenue, I think obviously clarification may be needed. For example, revenue line item at the start of the income statement that not necessarily equal to revenue from contract with customers applying IFRS 15. For example, interest revenue applying IFRS 9 also will be included in revenue line item. So, but with that, it's not necessary we needed to separate, we needed to include regulated income expenses into a revenue line item. I think that we needed to look at aggregation and disaggregation principle. We have kind of decided in terms of primary financial statements. I think nature is different, and I think to present that regulatory income and expenses separate will provide useful information to users. Second comment on regulatory, you know, interest income and expenses, whether they needed to be included in the finance income or finance expenses. I think there are two things we need to think about. One is that actually those regulatory interest income and regulatory interest expenses are part of total, you know, total allowable compensation. So I think from my perspective, all the components of total allowable compensation has same nature. So that means we should present those items, those components at the same place rather than in different places. Secondly, we can look at whether this regulatory interest income and regulatory interest expense really fits into our financing category, which we have decided in terms of primary financial statement. So for this is second comment. Third comment about the situation, the requirement, or the proposal we develop on offsetting regulated assets and regulated liability, in which the circumstance they will be, the company will be permitted to offset regulated assets and regulated liabilities. There are several comments made by stakeholders. Actually, when I look at those comments, actually let me be thinking about our proposal, because previously the proposal included in the exposure draft, actually we permitted those companies to offset those regulated assets and regulated liability that form separate units of account, and if, you know, two criteria met. So that is permission. But when I look at some stakeholders said that, okay, current IAS 12 income tax and IAS 32 financial instrument presentation have similar requirements there, but those requirements actually not permitted. That is a requirement. So I think that if those regulated assets liability are separate individual units of accounts, and they can, there is legal enforceable, you know, right to offset that. And the amount will be the same, will be based on net amount. I think from my perspective, in order to be consistent with IAS 12 and IAS 32, maybe should not be a permission, actually should be a requirement for company to offset those regulatory, you know, assets and liability. So this is another comment. Maybe we should revisit those, that proposal. Why, you know, whether permission is appropriate solution in terms of to be consistent with other standards.
Okay. You, Mary, you want to come back?
Yeah, I did. One is to agree with Jin Zhao, and it was something I forgot to mention in terms of the presentation of finance, regulatory interest and regulatory interest expense in financing. I personally don't feel like I want to explore that a lot further, in part because early on we'd heard a lot about how different regulators might not focus as much on, let's say, other regulatory returns versus something that they will name as interest. And so that they very much think about the packages as a whole. So in this instance, much as I support where we're going in primary financial statements in terms of separating out finance expense, I think I see an argument that we had in the ED for keeping that all together up at the top. And then the second is, I felt like I was just sounding grumpy and no about, you know, the revenue point, but just to give a bit more about why I feel so strongly, what we're trying to do with the regulatory income and regulatory expense is to identify impacts on the revenue line item. It's not revenue in this period. It's how we expect either future revenue to be impacted, because in future you will get a rate adjustment, or it's the reversal of a prior period that we now are seeing flow through in the revenue line. So I think there's a very, very different nature. And even if we weren't focused on the phrase from contracts with customers, I would expect the general disaggregation requirements to say that the nature of these two is such that you couldn't commingle them in a single line item called revenue. And so, you know, looking ahead to a basis for conclusion, I just wanted to say a bit more than grumpy no.
Oh, sorry, just a quick question, Mary. Is it the label revenue? So would they be okay to sum them, and as long as they label it something different?
I think that's something that I'd say let's think about, you know, with thinking from primary financial statements. And I don't know how much we should go into this, you know, in terms of detail, but this is where faithful representation might come in. You know, revenue adjusted for, but it's not adjusted, it's not adjusted revenue in the sense that this is not revenue. This is revenue adjusted for something else.
Yeah, because I don't have the paragraph here, but we have a paragraph in there that sort of says our goal is to sort of let you understand it as if the total allowed compensation, right? So we've got that that sense of getting you to a sort of a return that adjusts for these timing differences. And so I could see where a lot of people, especially, I don't have the paragraph, maybe somebody could take it out for me. If that paragraph is in there as a goal, then to say to people, well, you can't put them together, would sort of negate that goal. So I think that's why I'm actually quite in accord with you on not confusing revenue under IFRS 15, but that goal is there, and we probably need to leave some kind of a vehicle or path to get the goal. And I apologize, I wasn't able to pull it quickly.
I think it's more in the basis, I think, than a specific requirement in the AV.
Do you want to just read it in case, just to help
me? I'm looking for it.
But the presentation section does spell out what Mary just explained, that, you know, regulatory income is... It shows the effects on revenue in the future, so it's not revenue of the period. So we do have that explanation that Mary just explained, you know, in the basis in the presentation section. But at the same time, we also say that the objective is to reflect the total allowed compensation in the statement of financial performance in the period in which the goods or services are supplied.
Yes.
But would that get to your point on should we describe the subtotal as something rather than changing the revenue description itself to something else, or?
No, that's all I'm saying is because we have that paragraph, I think people will want to combine them in a presentation thing. And I agree with Mary that they ought not to call it total revenue, but I would be very concerned that we end up prohibiting something that seems to run against what we claim is an objective of the project.
Can we perhaps park that and move on? Because that was one of the lighter papers.
I mean, I was just about to say it's in paragraph 16 of the exposure draft, which says to supplement the information an entity provides by applying IFRS 15, this draft standard adopts the principle that an entity shall reflect the total allowed compensation for goods or services supplied as part of its reported financial performance for the period in which those goods or services are supplied. And then it goes on to say, to apply that principle, an entity shall recognize regulatory income, regulatory expense, and so on.
Okay. Anything more that you require from us on this one? Sorry, Rika. Thank
you. So next time we discuss about this presentation matter, I hope we can see what we can conclude the things we can conclude with the application of general principle in IS1 and other standards, and what we can, the other item that we have to specifically include something, some kind of requirement in this standard. So I think I would like to see two groups clearly about the basis of the requirements in the IFR standards that will help. I agree with what Jin Zhao and Mary had already mentioned about the classification and also separation of the revenue.
Okay. Something for you to chew on. Shall we move on to disclosure? Okay.
I'll move on to agenda paper 90, disclosures. This paper summarizes the feedback received on the proposed overall disclosure objectives, the proposed specific disclosure objectives, and the proposed disclosure requirements. I'll first touch on the overall disclosure objectives. Most respondents who commented, including all users of financial statements commented, they agree with the focus, the proposed focus, you know, on basically reporting an entity's financial, entity regulatory income, regulatory expense, regulatory assets, and regulatory liabilities. However, some respondents actually supported a broader overall disclosure objective that focused on providing information about the regulatory agreement, such as, for example, the nature of the agreement, the risk associated with agreements, and its effect on the financial statements, financial position, financial performance, and cash flows. In relation to specific disclosure objectives and disclosure requirements, some respondents, including all users of financial statements, supported the proposed requirements. Some users found the following disclosure particularly useful. First, the components of regulatory income and regulatory expense. Second, the maturity analysis of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. And third, the reconciliation of carrying amounts of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. On the other hand, some preparers and national standard setters raised concerns about some of these proposals, particularly the components of regulatory income and regulatory expense, and the maturity analysis of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. They were particularly concerned about the cost benefit, basically the cost will outweigh the benefits of providing those disclosures. And the details are actually set out in paragraph 37 to 38 of the paper. Respondents also commented on other topics. For example, some respondents actually request for, you know, additional disclosure requirements, such as significant judgment made in applying certain requirements. Some also suggested further guidance on specific requirements, such as aggregation, disaggregation, for areas that require significant judgment. A few respondents also asked the board to basically, you know, be informed by decision made on the disclosure initiative, targeted standards level review of disclosures project. That's all I have, and back to the board for discussion.
Thank you, Shopman. Anne.
Thanks for the paper. I've got three things I'd like to comment on. Two are comments and one's a question about knowing more. So firstly, about the disclosure objective and the request from some stakeholders for making it broader. I don't agree with that, and I agree with the arguments that we put forward in the basis of conclusions as to why we didn't go broader, why we didn't go back to an IFRS 14 idea. I'm happy with where we are on that one. The second one is about the aggregation and disaggregation. And I found some inconsistencies in the feedback, and that's something that I would like to know a bit more about, a bit more clarity. So, for example, paragraph 17, those people are saying that the disaggregation is just mechanical, the granular information won't give insights. And that contrasts quite a lot, for example, with paragraph 30. And in that case, I think we're hearing from users, and they say they value the disclosure of the components of regulatory income and regulatory expense. And then there are other places where people have asked for more guidance. So, you know, for me, that's something that I'd like to understand better, in terms of how that feedback's fitting together, because it seems in some places contradictory. The third thing I'd like to comment on is the people that have made comments on the disclosure-only solution, that pops up in various places. Say paragraph 18, people want to just be qualitative because they don't like the model. In 34, people are asking for some sort of exemption, really, in relation to confidential information or commercial sensitivity argument. And then again in 38, where people are saying a choice, allow them to just do qualitative. I reject those, well, the ones that are saying qualitative only, I reject that feedback. This is just far too complex to be presented in qualitative-only information. I can't see a disclosure-only solution working here, so I don't agree with those people. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Mary?
Several different points. Let me knock out a couple of the easy ones first. There was a suggestion at one point about satisfying some of the disclosure requirements by cross-referencing to regulatory filings, and I wanted to raise skepticism about that. We do at times decide that it's appropriate to allow cross-reference to material, what I will call in an old-fashioned way the annual report package, but I think when we start going further and further in terms of the range of documents, it gets harder and harder, and it reduces the overall understandability of the financial statements. So I wasn't supportive of that. I also wasn't supportive of the suggestion made to develop explicit disclosure requirements of significant judgments made in applying the model. We have a general requirement in IS-1 for disclosure of significant judgments. We shouldn't undercut it by rewriting it in selected places. Now, I'll climb off my soapbox and say maybe we should be including an illustrative example in this standard that shows how you take the existing and applicable requirement on IS-1 and think about it in terms of what some of the significant judgments may be here, and that might be a good illustration, but it's not developing new guidance that's specific to this topic. Like Anne, I was not very sympathetic to the request for relief on the grounds of commercial sensitivity. And I want to make clear that I'm keen to make sure that I understand why people would see this as highly commercially sensitive, which I struggled with, I didn't understand on the basis of the information that I had here. Because to me, when we remind people that you are making a judgment in the context of the boundaries of an existing regulatory requirement, you're not speculating about the likelihood that it's going to get renewed, or that new types of allowances will be granted in future. You know, you're working within the boundaries of the existing agreement. And so while I can see that there may be some judgments about, let's say, will the full amount of this cost, will this be considered prudent, et cetera, and when I think about what at least my sense is of the level of detail that we're talking about, I really struggle to see, even if an entity has only one regulatory agreement that it's reporting on, how it could get to commercial sensitivity. So I want to make sure we bottom out the comment, but I want to be clear that I wasn't really had any sympathy based on the information that we had so far that was something we should try to accommodate. I thought the point about the feedback from users was incredibly important, and we have to remember that and cite that. And I was glad to hear it highlighted in the tee-up, because it told us that specifically they value the time bands, that specifically they value the disaggregation, and specifically they value the reconciliation, and expect to use those to in the modeling. And so I think somebody would have to demonstrate to me that there are hugely disproportionate costs, associated with that before. Having had such specific feedback from users before, I'd start backtracking on that. Now, I don't know if some of that pushback on the disclosure is actually what I'll call the disclosure manifestation of disagreement with some decisions we made, you know, we proposed in the recognition and measurement piece, particularly with respect to construction work in progress.
Yep.
So, there may be some aspect of that, but I just wanted to say we should always go back to the anchor of that user feedback when we're thinking about, you know, cost benefit information. I think I got it all in the first try this time.
We'll see. Today.
Thank you, Andreas. I mean, that the one point that I would make here is basically the one that Mary made on judgment. A bit confused about that you said in the first paper to bring something to this paper that is specific. And I was just wondering about the paper B to say that there are a lot of comments on uncertainties, judgment, and I think that this is already covered, especially in IS1, and then definitely shouldn't bring this one. I mean, that we have to keep it principle-based, otherwise for every single standard we have this kind of request. I one thing that I struggle to understand is the one national standard set that referred to IS37. That I found, I might be wrong, but a bit dangerous, because actually we are not treating these as contingent. Actually, they are assets or liabilities. I mean that. And then I think that is, despite looks sounding reasonable, but actually it's outside of the IS37 scope. That's at least my view. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks very much, Andreas. I'm kind of a little bit on the other side of the camp in terms of the commercial sensitivity legal restrictions issue. I mean, I guess, well, let me put this, I'm not exactly entirely on the other side. I guess what I'd like to understand a bit more is, well, why are they saying that and have they cited examples of that? And I'll tell you why. Firstly, I think we've always got to be conscious that when somebody says revealing information could be commercially sensitive, we've seen this in other areas, I think we can't just exclude it. I mean, I think if somebody's turning around saying that there is an issue around something, I think it's important that we understand why. The one that worried me a little bit more was around the legal restrictions. I mean, I guess we need to remember we're dealing with governments here, and in a lot of situations there are, I've seen these agreements where there are restrictions on what things are allowed to be put into the public place, and we need to be conscious that because of the uniqueness of the public sector, there could be confidentiality clauses maybe in there. I guess what I'd like to understand is what are the examples we've got and how would we deal with those situations where there are legal restrictions put on entities dealing in the public sector that cannot be put on public. I know in some African countries that can be a big challenge for people in terms of what's put out there. The other one I was going to say on the significant judgments and that, I agree. I mean, I think it's already in there. I haven't got too much of a challenge of that. The ones I just want to talk a bit about was the components in paragraph 37. I guess we talked there about people raising the fact that there's obviously significant burden on preparers, and it's mentioned a few times on that. What I was interested in knowing is, given they're saying that this is going to be quite costly for them to give, are we comfortable that the disclosure we're giving has value to the users of financials in terms of that space? My assumption on this, I put you, was I think it does. But I think just to confirm that we're not going to make people go through a stage where they've continually raised an issue, this is going to be a big change in what they're doing, and we're not sure that there's some value that people are going to get in terms of what they put out there. As far as the quantitative versus qualitative, yeah, I mean, I think it is difficult. I do also think it's, I think it could be difficult to try and determine how we would just do it purely qualitatively. I mean, I also think that given the nature of this type of accounting, people would want to see a bit more on that. I guess what I was interested in saying was, quantitatively, I guess what I was interested in also understanding was maybe this is a bit of an interactive area where we start getting to the qualitative information around, well, if there are things like those legal restrictions and that, maybe there's something that can be built in that can allow people where they're not necessarily breaching laws, etc. The last thing I was just going to make the comment on the risks and uncertainties. I mean, guidance and examples, I think, is going to be very tough. I mean, if you look at the myriad of agreements and the different jurisdictions and the way they are structured, I would think we could write a book just on examples of what people would do in terms of this. And I always get concerned that just given that these risks and uncertainties, I think, are not going to be inherent to great regulated activities. I think each country will have various things that impact on it. I just worry we could literally end up writing examples that either are meaningless in 90% of the jurisdictions, or we'd have to end up writing 100 examples to try and cross it. So just not to try and do too much work in that area, where I think people just need to apply judgment and disclose what they think are the key risks and uncertainties. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce. Mariela, do you want to come in?
Yes, just to give a note on the comments that Mary and also Bruce have mentioned about the commercial sensitivity information and concerns around it. And let me know, Shermani, if you agree with the comment, but only a very few preparers mentioned something specifically or raised concerns on commercially sensitive information. And the concerns, we understand, are more into for them making an estimation that might interfere in the negotiations that they might have with the regulator going forward. So that's where the concern arises in here. So you, Standard, are making me do an estimate of when and how much I will be recovering this regulatory asset that has not yet been approved. And I will have to reveal this. However, that might interfere the conversations I will be having with the regulator in a few weeks' time. So I think that's the main concern in here. And on your comment, Bruce, on the components, I think that some of those stakeholders or respondents disagreeing with the components were disagreeing with the width of the breakdown proposed in the. So some would have said, yes, okay, so we need to disclose this further because that has been compiled in a single line item in the P&L. However, the componentization that you are suggesting in the AD is far too much for us. So I think it is in the width that the AD has done the breakdown of this line item. Thank you.
Zach?
So I'll be brief because I think most of my points have been made by others. But two things I wanted to comment on. One was first, a little bit of difficulty for me in going through and working out what's fundamental disagreement with the model and what's disagreement with the disclosures. And I think as we work our way forward from here, this is the initial package of feedback, so it can be harder to do that. I think we need to focus on those that are specific to the model, and that if we proceed with the model or the model as we modify it going forward, and what are very specific disagreements with items of disclosure. On the second point, I think for me, what became clear as you heard from users about the model and how it was going to work was the benefit of this project was really tying all three of the primary financial statements together. And that creates complex interactions between statement of profit and loss, what goes on the balance sheet, and how that's going to manifest future cash flows. And what was clear was that they thought the package of disclosures really let you get to the cash flows, which is what they were trying to forecast. And I think holding on to that is important when you have a complex model that tries to do all those things, which I think this qualifies. I've never heard anyone describe it as simple yet. then the disclosures necessarily will have to be somewhat complex, but you sort of need the complexity of those mechanics to actually make your forecasts. So I think that's been said a little bit, but I think framing it within that is important as well.
Thank you. Jinjiao?
Thank you, Andreas. Just three comments. First is about aggregation and disaggregation of disclosures, which you mentioned in paragraph 32. I think further clarification may be needed if we look at those comments, whether those disclosures need to be based on those individual regulatory agreement, or whether if those agreements are subject to same regulatory framework, they can be aggregated. So I think that is a fair point we need to consider. Second is, I think I have similar concern as that you said about paragraph, I think, 44. If those regulatory rights and obligation do not meet the recognition threshold of regulatory asset liability, whether those rights obligation will need to go to IAS 37, I think we should be very careful, I think. If they do not meet, from my perspective, actually just go to IFRS 15, revenue standards, because it will resolve the cost and the revenue arising from the arrangement, rather than to look at whether they needed to whether they are contingent assets or contingent liability, and further disclosure needs to be disclosed. I think we should be careful. Third comment is on paragraph 48. There are several suggestions for prepare to, you know, to disclose further disclosure. I think from my perspective, I look at those details, for example, to disclose the regulatory environment, the legal form or length of the regulatory arrangement, agreement, or even if the regulator is a related party, how to disclose those information. I feel, for example, if the first, whether it could be, you know, regulator could be a related party of the entity, I doubt it, because normally regulator should be independent. If it is, I think those related party disclosure requirement already be in the IS-24, rather than be in particular adjusted in this project. For others, for example, legal form or length of those agreements, I think maybe we require too much if we require a company to disclose those. And I don't think it will be helpful for users to disclose those information. So when we look at those additional disclosure recommendation, we should look at whether it really meets the disclosure objective we identified. Thank you.
Thanks, Junjiao. Tom?
Yeah, I think two comments. First on the sort of a broader overall objective. I think that when I sort of look at our management commentary proposals and some of the ones that are out there, that a lot of that request could be covered in a management commentary. I think sometimes because regulators don't have adequate management commentaries in their jurisdictions, we think we should put in the standards, but I don't think that's the appropriate solution. I don't think that's what we should do here. So I probably wouldn't do it here, although I would encourage any entity to do the proper thing in their management commentary. The other ones on 31 and 37, we can look at the components and see if they're unreasonable, but it seems to me when I looked at those paragraphs, a lot of it seemed to echo what the entities that are in allowance-based or incentive-based systems are worried about with respect to the actual recognition and measurement. And so I'd put a big caution about discussing disclosure until we've resolved the recognition and measurement. I think if we can resolve recognition and measurement for that, and there's sort of two classes, but for that class of entities, I think a lot of the disclosure issues may fall away. So again, I'd look at it if we don't resolve the recognition measurement, but I would think hard about resolving the recognition measurement, and at the same time thinking about tidying up the disclosures, because I think that's kind of essential to the success of the project. And as I said, I think it'll solve a lot of their concerns over disclosure.
Thank you.
I agree with what other board member already mentioned, so I only add one thing about paragraph 38. So when IFRS 15 was implemented, I think qualitative information about the time bound of when the revenue recognized over time helped a lot. Because, even though it said the qualitative information, but still it includes the quantitative information about when and how the entity recognized revenue. So I think consideration about such disclosure will be more aligned with what already disclosed in accordance with IFRS 15. And I think that kind of the small tweak will help the practice to implement the proper disclosure practice.
That concludes our.
Thank you. I'll now go to agenda paper 9C, or effective debt and transversion.
that the paper summarizes feedback received on the proposed transition requirements and the proposed amendments to IFRS 1, first-time adoption of IFRS standards. I'll first touch on the proposed transition requirements. Some respondents, including all users of financial statements, agreed with the full retrospective application. However, most respondents, other than users' financial statements, did not support full retrospective application. They were particularly concerned about basically the cost and complexity of determining the open balance of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, particularly, you know, relating to differences in timing relating to property, plant, and equipment. The details are actually summarized in paragraph 14 of the paper. Some respondents suggested permitting a modified retrospective application that provide relief from either one, restatement of comparative information, or two, provide specific relief, right? Such as, for example, you know, measurement simplifications. The details are summarized in paragraphs 16 and 17 of the paper. Many respondents who commented agreed with the proposed simpler approach for the past business combinations. However, a few respondents actually suggested that, you know, the net amount of adjustment be adjusted against equity as opposed to the proposed adjustment to goodwill. I'll now move on to effective date. Most respondents who commented asked for a longer transition period, such as a period of at least 24 to 36 months with early application permitted. This feedback summarized in paragraph 27 of the paper. The last item that I'm going to touch on is the proposed amendments to IFRS 1, first-time adoption of IFRS standards. A few respondents who commented suggested that the board consider basically interaction between the proposed transition requirements and the transition relief that exists in IFRS 1. For example, you know, how would the proposed transition requirements interact with the optional exemption IFRS 1 that, you know, first-time adopters have already adopted and elected in the past? I'll now hand over to the board for discussion.
I think it was really disappointing to get the low level of support we did on what we proposed. So as Sukmun has told us, some agreed and almost all users agreed, but we get this strong pushback from our preparer group and others. And it seems to turn around what we said in paragraph 14, which is where we said that we already have the inputs. So, you know, full retrospective will be possible. And so perhaps in our feedback, we have learned a lot about how some entities prepare their information. And so this does speak to Tom's point about there are people that don't like the model, and because they don't like the model, have very strong views about not liking the model, then that flows through firstly to disclosure, as Tom said, but then also to transition here. So how we respond, I think, to Tom's point, how we respond depends on how we decide, if we decide to change the model. And when you look at the feedback they gave us, it does make sense. So for some, you know, trying to do a full retrospective would be complex. You know, they just don't have the information, and that's been communicated to us. So I think there's an issue that we're going to have a good look at, and we've got some additional suggestions in there around paragraph 17 of particular things that we need to look at. And as we've seen, they're also asking for a longer transition period because of the complexity. Also, some people ask for more outreach on this specific point. I'm not sure that that's necessary, because I think that there are elements of our work that will resolve things. So I'm not sure that we need more outreach. I think we have got a lot of feedback to work through first. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Nick?
Thanks. As Zach highlighted earlier, you know, part of this model is the interaction between the P&L, the balance sheet, and the statement of cash flows, helping to predict the future cash flows, I should say. And this is a new model. I think it's essential that we get a high level of understandability for users from the start. And for me, that would mean full retrospective application. I think that'd be very important for users to understand what's going on here. If I had to trade, I would trade that for a longer transition period. But that's where I would sit with that.
Mary?
A similar overall reaction to what Nick has just said. I was focused particularly, to me, on the importance of the comparative period being restated. I guess I was, you know, Nick, you're talking about full retrospective application. I guess I was thinking about needing to get the comparative period or periods restated. And like you, I would trade that off for a slightly longer period to the mandatory effective date, not 5 years as was suggested, but something maybe a bit more than we had proposed. In something that Anne mentioned about, we've been informed of the, you know, some of the challenges with information availability. I wanted to make a general observation that was a surprise, and the theme of surprise runs through last month's and this month's paper, because one of the things we were told when we were encouraged to take on this project is we have to do detailed adjustment by adjustment reporting to rate regulators. So a lot of this information is available and is available without significant cost. And we've gotten very different feedback now that we put out a proposal that was based on that initial encouragement. So maybe we're hearing from different people, and especially getting to a broader audience. But I think we have to not just accept it as it's too hard, it's too deep, you know, for us to require detail, but make sure that we understand when that kicks in. Having said that, when it comes to transition, you know, Nick already talked about the timing, but I also had maybe a bit more sympathy for making certain calculations as of the date of transition. So let's say beginning of the earliest comparative period stated, so that rather than having to go back and in effect relayer what all your adjustments would have been to say, you know, to use maybe the most, you know, the estimate as of that date, or particularly rates in effect at that time, rather than requiring lots of remeasurement. So I'd encourage the staff to think about how we could address the most significant cost concerns by looking at something as of the date of transition. But the other thing, and I did want to flag this as well, is and maybe it's the consequence of this being summary information rather than all the specifics, but some of the feedback we were getting about BizCom and the difficulty of applying the rate-regulated activities standard retrospectively raised questions for me about exactly how people are applying IFRS 14 today. And what I mean by that is people asked if they could use the IFRS 14 carrying value of PP&E as, you know, as a transition amount. Well, IFRS 14 says PPE shall be measured in accordance with IFRS standards. You may have a regulatory adjustment that's kept separate from that, but that means that there shouldn't be any adjustment to PPE as a result of applying ED. And when it comes to BizCom, the adjustments that you'd have were with respect to what you did or didn't recognize for regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. If you're already reporting using IFRS standards, then there was no relief from applying IFRS 3 to those past business combinations with the exception of the regulatory assets and liabilities. It's a different question for entities that are first-time adopters, that would be first-time adopters of IFRS standards, when they're picking up this rate-regulated standard as well. But some of the requests for relief on transition, if I assume that they are from entities that are reporting under IFRS standards today, seem excessive when I think about what the current requirements are. So that's maybe a poke at the credibility of some of those assertions requests. But I, you know, bottom line, I think it's really important to have at least one comparative period on a comparable basis. I would look for reliefs at the date of transition. You know, along the lines of some of the things that we have for IFRS 1 today, I would be very careful in our communication that we're talking about transition with respect to the regulatory asset and regulatory liability aspects of things, and that this is not a pervasive reconsideration of the measurement of every asset and liability, every item of income and expense in your financial statements.
Thanks, Mary. Bruce?
Thanks very much. I'm pretty much close to where Nick and Mary were. I mean, I guess when I took a look at this, I mean, I've always got sympathy for people on first-time adoption of a complex standard, and I always think we should try and do something. But I must say, I was quite swayed by the arguments in 13A and B. I mean, and in different ways. I mean, to start off with the one in B, I thought was a very permanent one. I mean, when we moved to IFRS 15, everybody was coming off the same base as in IS 18 and IS 11. We don't have that here, which means we haven't got, people can't look back and see a comparability. My worry is we're coming from this massively diverse accounting into this new one. And I think if you couple that with the fact that a lot of these are long-term contracts, that they're generally not short-term from my experience, which means you could have years before people have got a track record or comparability, before there's any value in the numbers that they've done. I worry that just could kind of, people could say, well, that's great, guys. We'll see the impact of this new standard in 10 years when eventually there's some sort of comparability. So I keep thinking to myself, I can't see another way of doing this other than retrospectively for it to have value to people. I do kind of see where Mary's going, and I think she's right. Maybe there are ways in which we can simplify, so I'd support that. Let's explore ways there are that we can try and maybe make some sort of adjustments to make it a bit easier. But I just think, I mean, if we tried to go to a prospective approach only, I just don't think there's much use in the numbers in terms of what they're doing. As far as the extended period, yeah, look, I think that given, on the same basis, given this is so different for people, and they are coming from a different place where they've been using different types of accounting. When I think of people moving from 18 and 11 to 15, it was easy because everybody had, there were templates, there were tools, there were wonderful things out there that took people from one to the other. But it was coming off the same base to the same base. We haven't got that here, which means people are going to need a little bit of extra time. So I am quite sympathetic to extending the period. I agree. I wouldn't quite go 5 years, but I think we would definitely look at a longer lead time to give people some chance to get into the application office. Thanks.
Thanks, Bruce. Jin Chao.
Thank you. I think a lot of comments has been said. That just the one comment, I think one factor maybe we need to think about when we improve our proposal in terms of transition arrangement. I think maybe for those companies, maybe the starting point may be different in different jurisdictions. Some companies already currently applying IFRS 14 or US GAAP or their local GAAP available on this specific area. So maybe their detailed information already available for them. Some companies, some local GAAP, some jurisdictions have no this kind of specific accounting standards available at this moment. So maybe for those companies, I think they need to spend more time to track back all those detailed information. For example, Bruce said sometimes those contracts may be very long-term period. So I think the cost for those companies may be very high. They need to track back. They need to make sure the detailed information, particularly those components of total allowable compensation. I think so. I have a little bit sympathy with those companies. Currently, they do not have specific accounting treatments in terms of recognizing regulatory assets and liability. Maybe they need more time, more cost. So if we can simplify a little bit for those transition arrangement, I think those companies will appreciate and also will help them to implement these standards. But obviously, to make sure the transition, the starting date of regulatory assets liability right, also very important because it will impact subsequent measurement many, many years. So I think we need a balance, but I do have sympathy with those. I think those entities may say that maybe they need to track a lot new information back for many, many years. Currently, maybe they have not yet do it by now. Yeah.
Rita?
Thank you. I think I feel like there is always a risk of having a longer preparation period after publication of the final standard. If the time is winter is long, then the practice start discussing over what we have already discussed and finalized. So I think I prefer Mary's idea to have some kind of the modified retrospective effective application, like but IFRS 15 has. So, and I also think I agree with Jin-Chao's point. There are diverse practice, and some entity have not yet applied anything about this type of the arrangement. So I don't think there might be a huge difference between the first time adopter and other entities those entities are going to apply these standards initially without applying IFRS 14. So I think I hope the staff firstly consider how we can modify the initial application transition of these standards for all entities, including first-time adopters. And then if it's really necessary to consider something else for the first-time adopter, then we should consider specifically for the first-time adopters.
Anything more we can do for the team on this one, other than showing our disappointment? Maybe not. Okay, let's move to the last paper then.
So thanks, Andrews. So last paper we have on retroactive activity response is agenda paper 9D, a feedback summary, likelihood facts, and other comments. So overall, most respondents believe that the benefit the proposals would bring to the users would exceed the cost of implementing the proposals for preparers. Most respondents also agree with the analysis of the likely effect of implementing the proposals on information reported in financial statement and on the quality of financial reporting as described in paragraph 7 and 8 of the paper. However, a few respondents said applying some of the proposals would not improve the quality of the financial reporting because these proposals do not reflect the economic substance of the regulatory agreements. This is described in the paragraph 11 of the paper. Sorry. With respect to the likely cost of implementing the proposals, many respondents agree with the board's analysis in paragraph 15 of the paper. However, some respondents disagree. These respondents include mainly preparers as well as some national standard setters and accounting firms. These respondents thought the proposals would be costly and complex to implement both on initial implication and on an ongoing basis. This is discussed in paragraph 17 and 18 of the paper. Finally, paragraph 18 and 23 provide a summary of the feedback received on the cost of implementing different aspects of the proposals. Some of these aspects were discussed by the board in October, while others have been discussed during this meeting. Now I will leave the comments to you, board.
Thank you, Sujet. Any comments, members? Tadeo.
Some comments here. First, the comment that the cost of implementing could be passed to customers. I mean, that almost everything will be passed to customers every time that you have a cost. And probably if they can do that, it would be an allowed expense. And that, I think that, but it's just a point that I'm just trying to make, that it doesn't look like a technical point to make here. That's the, not saying that they are wrong. Another point is that I would explore, try to understand what is in paragraph 13, when they say that when we have this matching with the recognition of some revenue and expenses applying IFRS standards. I mean, that they say that such matching do not always represent adjustment to the future regulated rates. I mean, I would try to understand exactly in which situation, because it's supposed that we have designed for what would be an allowed expense, for example.
Yeah. But we do have a bunch, but I could be asked could we answer you right now?
Yeah.
I think this preparer is thinking of regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities that would arise because of differences between the regulatory recovery pace and the assets' useful lives. And yes, they do get compensation, but they don't think they get compensation necessarily linked to the depreciation expense. They get a compensation based on the depreciation of the regulatory capital base, which is different from their point of view to the PP&E. Therefore, linking compensation to depreciation expense is not necessarily respecting or reflecting the economics of the regulatory agreements in their perspective, because the regulator will not allow them or oblige them to increase or decrease future rates because of those differences between the recovery of the regulatory capital base and the useful life of the assets. Therefore, from their point of view, those differences would never translate into future adjustments to the rates. This is the problem here.
I think that if this is the case, the issue is another one. I mean, that there are many cases in where the regulatory basis are completely different from the accounting basis.
Yeah.
But then, at this point, is another bigger issue, not necessarily the one that is, at least I understood from paragraph 13. And another
manifestation of, you know, the measurement proposals that people don't like. So it's just continuing.
And in relation to discounting, I couldn't avoid mentioning that one. I mean, that every time that someone says that discounting is not relevant, it doesn't came from an economy, a country with high interest rates or inflation. I mean, discounting in many countries is quite a relevant issue. That's why I really appreciate if people realize that sometimes it might make a big difference. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadeo. Mary.
I'll start by jumping on Tadeo's discounting point and give a second vote in favor of that assertion. I think, you know, even in countries that have had a relatively low interest rate and inflation rate for the past decade, we are starting to see higher rates. And I think to build a standard that says you can just use nominal amounts without considering discounting, it would be a fatal flaw, frankly. And I did struggle more generally with why the expected costs of the discounting requirements are so high, because we could have said for every regulatory asset and liability, determine what a market rate of return would be, and then adjust the difference between the regulatory rate and that rate for everyone. And we didn't. We baked a huge, you know, cost savings in terms of saying, if you get, you know, if you have a regulatory asset, then consider whether the rate that you get is adequate. And as long as it's adequate, as long as you get over that threshold, you don't have to adjust it. You don't have to reset it. You don't have to have the, you know, the equivalent of an EIR, et cetera. And that's a huge simplification that just says, you know, are we getting compensation for time, you know, time value of money, and, you know, considering the risks involved. And yes, you have to make that in theory on an item by item basis, but frankly, I can see so many opportunities. For example, looking at how rates are set, and as long, you know, by in a particular regulatory agreement, or being able to do it for class of items, that it's not something you're going to have to say every day. I have to set aside half my day to assess today's, you know, today's rate. So I really struggle with those comments given the simplification we have already baked in. And so I guess my question, comment in terms of follow-up is, are we sure that they understood the focus on adequate rate versus reset? And if they did, then why are the costs so much different than what we expected? And then a couple of other less significant items. Something in this paper made me just stop and think about whether we need to provide any guidance on reporting cash flows related to recovery or revisions of regulatory asset and regulatory liability. I'm not sure that we do, but I'm also been a bit more sensitized recently to the idea of to work with the statement of cash flows, you also need information about non-cash changes that affect the reconciliation. So maybe just thinking about whether there's anything specific that we have to comment on about the impact of IS7, you know, the interaction of IS7 with our requirements on regulatory assets and liabilities. I'd be happy if the answer was no, but I think we should just pause and think about it. And the last, there was a suggestion about doing an analysis of the differences versus U.S. GAAP. That is something that my reaction is that's not for us to do in the standard setting process. We deliberately, a long time ago, started down a route that was not a modified version of U.S. GAAP. It was to measure the impact on revenue of rate regulation, not a partial, you know, cost deferral. And, you know, even if we could at any one point in time include an analysis versus U.S. GAAP as written, I think that would be almost have some moral hazard, because many different regimes say that they are converged with or based on U.S. GAAP, but the way they are applied in practice varies quite widely. And I think it would maybe downplay a wide range of differences that exist and wouldn't be captured in a paper-to-paper version of just those two. So I think that there are others who can step into that space and provide that kind of intellectual property. Let's not try and do it as part of the standard setting.
I agree with Mary about her comments about US GAAP model. That's not what I wanted to talk about, but I agree with those comments because we made a decision to do a different sort of model, and I don't think we should be doing that request. What I did want to ask about was the people that are in the agree category. So you very carefully talked to us about the disagree, and you said you had a range of respondents who disagree, and that's important for us to understand. But I'd like to know the mirror image. I'd like to know more about who was in the agree. So do we have some preparers in the agree, or are they all over in disagree? So, you know, to what proportion of preparers, regulators and auditors are actually in the agree? I'm trying to get a handle on, you know, we've had this strong feedback from certain entities about the model. I'm trying to get a feel for how pervasive that is. Have we got areas where the preparers are really comfortable with the model? They aren't in the cost and complexity camp. So just some better feel for that. Thank you.
Any instant comments on that? See, no. All right. I see no further comments. Do you have any further questions to ask beyond what's in the paper?
No, we don't have anything else to ask the board. We will be presenting the next steps for the project in December, so we will see you again in a few weeks' time.
Excellent. I treat this as a promise. All right. With that, then we can close this agenda item, and we now pause our board meeting and reconvene at 2:00. Ha ha ha.